recording. So welcome to this podcast. It's called Nobody Cares. If new people are joining us today, sorry for my accent, I'm from Switzerland. But you're here for their answers, Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. Not my question, I imagine. If you're used to listen to our podcast, this time we will be talking in English. So sorry for all of our European and French listeners. And we will be talking about Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead's career. Did I get your name right?
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. They have recently done the movie Spring. They previously have done the movie Resolution. So yeah, last time we spoke was 3 years ago, I think. Right after Resolutions was screened at the NIF. Ever since that, you've traveled a lot. What lessons did you take away from your time on the road?
Ooh, what lessons?
Yeah.
We didn't really know. We had kind of an idea for why we were doing all of the travel, besides the fact that it's just a lot of fun, you know. But it was kind of like every little bit, you're just more inclined to go see the movie if there's some kind of personal investment. It's like, oh, the directors are in town, you might go to that one instead of the other one, you know. And so it was kind of like a grassroots marketing thing. Of course, you know, we can't go one by one by one to everybody and convince them to go see our movies. Hopefully we can, but sometimes that even fails. But that was kind of the idea, besides the fact that it's tons of fun and, you know, you only get one time where you can subsidize some travel to all over the place, you know. But what it turned out to be, really, is that the benefits are really intangible while you're doing it, but you just have to do it enough, you know, and cast your net wide enough and go to enough of them that it starts becoming worth your while. Like our first movie, Resolution, you know, it was kind of just made by the two of us, but we would not have been able to make Spring had we not done our festival travel, met a whole bunch of people. Spring takes place in Italy, you know, and we're over here in LA, and we wouldn't have been able to find our cast if we hadn't met all these people all over the place. We wouldn't have been able to find our location. We happened to be at another festival in Italy, and we talked to the film commission there, just casually, kind of on a one-off, like, hey, we have this script called Spring. It wasn't before we were, like, going to go make it. And they were able to find a location where it's actually feasible to shoot the film. And that's just two examples, you know, but it was all over. We didn't know when we were going to that festival that we were going to go and try to get Spring made there. We didn't know at the festival, it was like, oh, if we meet this person, maybe we can meet the actress we're looking for. Like, we had no idea. We were just out and having a good time and keeping in touch with people and promoting the film. And it turned out that turned into making the movie possible. You know, oh, we went to a film festival in Estonia, you know, arbitrarily met somebody who introduced us to somebody else who introduced us to our visual effects company. And so the visual effects were done in Estonia for Spring. And that's it, where it's all over the place that we wouldn't have been able to do it that way, and, you know, for that affordably or at all, you know, if we hadn't kind of just taken that in our own hands and gone with it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And there's also this this thing that happens, you don't realize it's happening, but you go back to a city with your second movie, and when you show up to the film festival and you're there, you realize that your audience has doubled or tripled, and it wouldn't be doing that had it not been you were there before. Certain people remember it, they're going to show up, and then so are, like, the new people.
Yeah, and they're going to talk about it.
Yeah, and it, you know. And it feels, and even then it's like, well, okay, you're talking about the amounts of dozens of people, but with social networking, it's actually, it's a lot more than that. It makes a big difference, and it's one of the most neat things when you go back to a small town with your second movie and your audience is so much bigger, and it's just because you were there with your first. It's really neat.
Yeah. Funny that you mentioned social media, because my next question is about it. So ever since Resolution, you relied a lot on social media to promote not only your movies, but I feel your persona. Is that a word in English? Okay. Is it because it's a smart way to go nowadays, or because you've always enjoyed stuff like Reddit or YouTube videos?
Both.
Both?
You know, both. Sometimes it feels like a bit of an obligation, but for the most part it's because, you know, I mean, everybody lives online nowadays, pretty much, and that's kind of part of it. It's just an easy way to express yourself all the time. And, Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, making YouTube videos, that's like, we make movies for a living. It's kind of like, it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, at a certain point, it starts feeling like an obligation, and that's normally when we cool it. But otherwise, yeah, it's just enjoyable. Also, just to be able to talk to people about the movie that you otherwise might not be able to, or just thank them and stuff like that. It's a nice feeling, because otherwise you're just sitting in your room in front of a computer working on your next thing, and it feels very isolated, and, you know, it's cool to actually be able to talk to people that enjoy it. So,
and if you can use social networking to help build awareness of what it is you do, your voice as filmmakers, then you can decrease your reliance on, for example, stars to get your movie made.
Yeah.
You know, the best position you want to be in is someone like Kevin Smith, where it doesn't really matter who he casts that much, because it's a Kevin Smith movie, and that's why he gets the money to make it, and that's why it's profitable. That's the situation you want to be in as a filmmaker. You don't want to be in a situation, or get away from the situation of being like, this is wonderful, the script's perfect, it's so good, now just go get Tom Cruise to be in it, and we'll go make it. The goal is, in your career, you want to get to a place where you can make it, because it's a Moorhead and Benson film.
Yeah, and stars might just come to you, or something
yeah.
like that. Basically, our model, except for the fact that they're extremely press shy and we're not, is the Coen brothers. You know, the Coen brothers can make a movie that people aren't just like, okay, so what genre does it go in? Like, how do we sell this thing? It's like, oh, it's a Coen brothers movie. You know, that's just what it is. Now they just continually make really good movies, and that's how they built their brand. You know. We try to do the same, but also hopefully pack a little bit of extra punch by having a bit of a social outreach. So
I think you do pack a lot of points from your social outreach.
Cool, thank you.
So, speaking about Reddit, you recently did an AMA in which you ranked the NIF, Neuchâtel International Fantastic Film Festival, VAL, amongst your two favorite film festivals. So,
mm-hmm.
Was it a way for you to get invited again? or is Switzerland really lucky enough to have one of the best fantastic film festivals of the world?
Well,
it actually has the best film fantasy.
Why?
It just does.
Have you been to
other?
I mean, they're all amazing.
They're all amazing.
It's just like, have you been to NIF? Like, it's so fucking awesome.
I go to NIF every year.
Yeah,
of course.
So it's possible that. Now, Neuchâtel was our international premiere. So it was our second film festival after Tribeca. And it's possible that we're looking at it through like rose-colored glasses, and we just remember that being like, we were very overwhelmed by everything, you know. But, I mean, we've now been to a ton of film festivals, and they're all extraordinarily fun. But I look back, and it's not just, you know, I mean, I can look even at the practical aspects of it, of just kind of like, how beautiful it is there, and how nice everybody is, and how, you know, how beautiful everyone is, and how, like, you know, you could just, we never felt like we needed a phone. We could just kind of walk out there and find everybody. And even though it's really well attended, you know, I heard a statistic of something like Neuchâtel has 35,000 people in it, and 30,000 people attended the festival, you know, and that means from all over all over Switzerland and elsewhere.
And when other filmmakers are there, other artists, other people, you bond with them there in this very unique environment.
We met Kieran Foy there from Citadel, and we've kept him. He's now one of our closest friends, and we still keep in touch. And when I say keep in touch, I mean like we see him all the time. He lives near us now. He used to he used to live in the UK or Ireland. I can't remember. Which
Ireland.
One? Yeah, Ireland. Yeah, yeah.
Isn't Ireland in the UK?
Well, there's Northern Ireland is in the UK. See, okay, hey, European listeners, we are showing that we actually know these borders.
Exactly.
Northern Ireland is in the UK. Ireland is not, and I couldn't remember if he's which one he's in. But anyways, he moved over here now, and so we keep in touch. Jonathan Zarantanello, he had the Butterfly Room at Neuchâtel. We ended up staying with him in Rome and hanging out with him a little bit. And, geez, who else? Jennifer, one of the jury member there. We've seen her at other festivals, and that's always really fun. I'm sure there's a few others we're forgetting.
You?
Yeah, you're one. We see Anaïs on occasion out at festivals, you know. Anaïs Emery? She runs NIF?
Oh, yeah, but I have never met her.
What? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. I was trying to promote the NIF and to stick it in my friends who live in Paris, you know. And we have the PIF. Fuck you. We have the
NIF. Oh, we love PIF too.
PIF's good too.
They're all great. That's the thing, is there's no festival that's not awesome. You know, we've never been to a festival that's like, let's get out of here.
Let's be honest. Neuchâtel is way better than Paris.
I'm not gonna say that. I'm not gonna say that. I'm just saying Neuchâtel.
You're not gonna say that.
I'm just saying I absolutely adore NIF. It's one of my favorite.
You're not gonna say that on record. I'll get it out of you later. So, from what I gathered, you're currently working on Beast, an Aleister Crowley biopic. Can you tell us a bit more about that? How was your interest for this man born, and how far along are you into the process of doing it?
I first discovered Aleister Crowley by I was reading an interview with Alan Moore. Do you know Alan Moore?
Yeah.
And I was reading an interview with Alan Moore because I love his writing, so I had to read his interviews and see what the man's like. And his interviews are really always super entertaining. He's a really eloquent, witty guy. Yeah. But he got on the topic in the interview of ceremonial magic and his practice of ceremonial magic.
Yeah.
And then so that obviously leads into his conversations about Aleister Crowley and what he admires him for, how he interprets him, what he doesn't like about him. And he got into some other ceremonial magicians too. But most of the time he was talking to Aleister Crowley. And so I'm like, oh, who's Aleister Crowley? So I go and I Wikipedia Aleister Crowley. And then behold, the most interesting Wikipedia page I've like ever seen. And then years later, Aaron and I were at a film festival. We were at Strasbourg.
Strasbourg?
Yeah, we were there. And we saw a certain film festival guy we see around film festivals. And I was like, hey, that's like a more handsome Aleister Crowley. And Aaron's like, who's Aleister Crowley? I was like, dude, look at this Wikipedia page. And then Aaron goes down the rabbit hole. And then like we're both like kind of obsessed with it. And then like 6 months later, we were at Cannes Film Festival trying to find a producer.
Actually, I'm going to add to the story something we both completely forgot. You wrote a short film
that
involved
right.
Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley.
Okay.
That we just developed a little bit. That was around Scream Fest, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That was around October after. Anyways.
Yeah, and then we were trying to find a producer for Spring at the Cannes Film Festival. And we were at this producer's roundtable. Where usually nothing ever comes of it, and it's kind of silly. It's a bunch of producers sitting around talking about their projects, and you're supposed to, it's like speed dating kind of.
But the thing is everyone has their own projects, but no one's like the person that's like, I've got a lot of money and no
everyone's
projects.
Looking for money. Everyone's looking for money.
Yeah, everyone's just kind of like, some people just kind of have an idea, you know, and it's kind of like, oh, what is this? We're all just kind of telling each other about it. Nobody's going to get paired off.
There's this funny joke when you talk about producers as a filmmaker where it's like every producer has notes and very few have like, here's the money to make it, you know. But everyone's got notes. Like everyone's, if notes were money, you could just make anything you wanted.
Yeah.
But there was this one this woman at the table with us named Pamela Hansen, and she said, I have this project about Aleister Crowley, and I was like, oh, that sounds so cool. And she kind of told us what the premise would be. She had it set up in Scotland with their Creative Scotland, which is like their government soft money organization. And then we're like, well, we're interested. Why don't you like check out our movie and see if you think we'd be a good fit for it? And she went and she watched Resolution. And she saw something like in the tone of Resolution, the way we did it, that she thought would be a really good match for the material. So, and then we were hired to go make an Aleister Crowley movie.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened.
It. Yeah.
And 14, 15 months later, we just sent out the script.
Yeah.
And,
so basically we're at casting. That's kind of where it's at. It's
okay.
Looking good, though. I mean, it just went out. So we have a new title. It's called The Wickedest Man in the World.
Of course.
Do you guys mind if I take off my pants?
Take it off.
All right. For the listeners, I'm now sitting without pants.
It was the way you were dressed the first time we met, remember?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't wear pants at film festivals.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a smart way.
He feels comfortable.
No pants,
you
feel really comfortable, like you're at home.
Yeah.
So, Robert Downey Jr. has been very vocal about not wanting to star in independent movies and has had some pretty harsh words towards them.
Oh.
You've heard
yeah,
about
I know
that.
What you're talking about.
Okay,
yeah.
Since you can't trash talk a guy like Robert Downey Jr., let's pretend Justin Bieber said it.
Actually, no, I'll talk pretty openly about it.
Okay, what would you answer, Justin Bieber or Robert Downey Jr., since you're badass, in defense of independent movies?
You know, I honestly think people were looking for something to get upset about. Like, everything he said about indie films is completely true. That happens all the time. I used to be a low-budget DP, and also on our own films. It's like, yeah, they're hard. They're exhausting. He's like, not wrong. They're hard and exhausting, and sometimes that's you can choose whether or not to do that. Does that mean that they're not a worthwhile enterprise? No, not of course not. Like, a lot of things that are worthwhile are worth the difficulty. But he was basically just saying, like, sometimes they're really exhausting, and sometimes that's not worth it. And if it's not worth it to him, like, you know, that's his thing. That's fine. But I think, you know, I mean, I don't mind the struggle, but I understand it, and you can choose whether or not to dive in. You know,
the only thing he said that I would, I don't know if taking issue is the right word, the only thing he said that, like, definitely came across just like, oh, come on, man, was like, and then I got to go to Sundance and sit in a chair for 6 days doing press. And it's like, you know,
that's
doing
hard.
Press is not a difficult, you can, I guess you really dislike it, you got to do it all the time, but it's just, I mean, people are bringing you nice little snacks and food, and you're sitting, so yeah, it's true, you got to do a lot of press when you go to a film festival. But I think to complain about that, particularly at like a ski resort location, it's hard to not, that for not to come across.
That's
like,
good.
Man, there's people with hard-ass jobs, man.
Yeah.
And that is not, there is nothing actually hard about doing press, even though that sometimes people will be like, yeah, it must be really hard, I empathize with it. It's actually incorrect, it's not hard at all. It's the easiest thing in the world, and you're kind of taken care of the whole day. And so it's not...
I think it's just coming from a place of, like, a guy who is in Robert Downey Jr.'s situation, he can choose to not do that, and might be better off for it in terms of just his own life enjoyment. Not in terms of his creative work. Like, that's, you know, we don't... That's neither here nor there in this conversation. We're just talking about, like, you know, at a certain point, you're going to retire. That doesn't mean... Like, at a certain point, people retire, right? Now, he's not about to retire necessarily, but it's like... But like... I think that by criticizing what he's saying is being like, oh, you're retiring, that means you're giving up. And it's like, no, sometimes you just don't want to do it anymore. It's exhausting. Working is exhausting. And so that's it, where it's like, you're right. Like, that kind of thing is like, it's definitely a place where a lot of other people want to be. But he has the choice to just not do that and to be at home, you know, swimming in his pool. And it would be about the same for him.
Yeah.
Now, we do have to shelve the idea of creative success, though, because, you know, in my opinion, like, you know, there's exciting stuff going on in indie film and pretty unexciting stuff going on at Marvel, and in terms of like breaking molds. And so, you know, that's a different conversation. But I think he's just talking about, like, is it worth it to him anymore? And it's like, if it's not, like, that's his choice. I think it's his choice to, like, not want to do that.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
What movie had most influence on your life? And have you ever had a life-altering movie experience? That's actually a question that you asked me.
Yeah?
Yeah, on Facebook once.
Oh, hang on, what did you answer, though?
Gravity.
Wow, I don't remember that, actually.
You don't
I feel
remember
bad.
That?
We talked like 2 months ago, though.
Yeah.
I totally forgot, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay, okay.
Yeah.
You love my answer, so...
Yeah.
So what's yours?
Gravity, no. I think it's a hard one. It's hard to know when it's happening. You know, you have to, like, look back, and then you're like, oh, that's right, when I saw that movie. You know, I think the easiest one to grasp, because I remember, like, as soon as it was over, that was when it was like, oh, you can do that kind of thing, was probably Children of Men.
Okay.
That kind of thing where it's like, oh,
was a Cuarón movie.
Yeah, exactly. For me, it was like, that was. I didn't even make the connection there, even though obviously and it wasn't just the impressive long takes. I think that's probably what got me in the moment, but it's also thinking back on it and being like, oh, that's right, like, you know, post-apocalyptic or dystopian kinds of movies that I liked don't have to be like giant cheeseball action affairs. They can actually still be really grounded in like a human drama, and that's all it really has to be. And, you know, on top of like super impressive, you know, documentary handheld style camera work was really cool. But Yeah, I think it was more just kind of like being able to hit a tone that didn't feel like this was like an overdeveloped, like, oh, where's the next action set piece coming from? I think of movies like, I haven't seen it, to be honest, but I think of a movie like Book of Eli, and I think like, oh, it's probably a pretty like unprofound experience, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really go into like a deep human drama. And yeah, I think Children of Men was probably like, okay, it can be done. That kind of thing, like that kind of like dead serious, even though it's in another world and all of that, but it can still be done like on a totally human level.
Mm.
What about you, Justin?
Probably Fellowship of the Ring was a big one. Almost Famous is a big one.
Why? Almost Famous is also one of mine, so, but why was it for you?
I think that it was just seeing, I mean, I don't think I realized it at the time I just really liked it. I was
yeah.
moved by it. But I think that what it is that it shows that sometimes really, really heartfelt, warm storytelling is honest, and it's not just like a like a bad romantic
yeah.
comedy or something. Like sometimes it is honest, and that's possible. You can make these like crowd pleasing movies that are also very, very, very honest and say something. And then probably any movie by Richard Linklater, in the sense that just realizing that, oh, you can make plotless movies, and it's
yeah.
not bad. Like, sometimes plotless movies are way better than movies with good plots, you know? And that's a huge realization. And then also... Inglourious Basterds. Inglourious Basterds was a big one because I wasn't... Growing up, I thought that Quentin Tarantino, I thought that, like, things like Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, I thought they were just... kind of, I think I saw them when I was too young, so I didn't understand it entirely, and I saw them as these things that you say you like when you like other alternative stuff.
Yeah.
But then I remember like seeing Inglourious Basterds as an adult and being like, oh, that is cinema. That is like brilliant cinema in every way. And then going back and watching Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs and realizing, oh, like, no, these movies are absolutely perfect. They're electric. Like, every line of dialogue, everything in it is, it's like, it's a perfect pop song, whatever you want to call it. It's just, it's wonderful, and it breaks every rule. So yeah, that was a big one.
I think it's like, it's really weird, because I remember I didn't understand Quentin Tarantino until recently.
Yeah.
Genuinely. I thought he was kind of like, oh, let's just be completely, when I was younger, I was like, oh, I really didn't like him, because I just thought he was kind of just brain firing, and, you know, just trying to be like, as random as possible in a way. And I didn't understand that all of that is actually just an emotional expression of himself and is actually really well curated and beautiful. And I think, you know, when I think of, you know, you go to college, and as an icebreaker, everyone says, like, everyone has to stand up and say, like, what's your favorite three movies?
And everybody
and frat boys stand up, and they all say Fight Club, I like Pulp Fiction,
yeah.
and then there's like one other, like Trainspotting or something like that, where basically it's like, it's a movie that's just fun enough to enjoy, but like they don't say some movie that makes them sound stupid that they actually enjoy even more, and that's what that always represented to me. And then I like go and watch those movies, and it's like, no, that movie just somehow is able to appeal to art house and like mainstream sensibilities in a way that's transcendent, you know. So it's like these movies are actually really, 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 really good, and still somehow can hook the people that just don't care about movies in a deep and passionate way, you know.
Yeah.
And that's very special. So
I agree. I will disagree about Inglourious Basterds, but I agree about everything.
That's the one everyone I know. I've heard lots of people say it. There's a lot of people that are like huge Reservoir Dogs fans. They're huge Pulp Fiction fans. That's universal across the board. And then you get to Kill Bill, and people are kind of like, I like it all right. And then some people really dislike Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, I didn't dislike it, but it was enjoyable, but it wasn't... It was Tarantino doing what we expect from Tarantino, I feel.
That's the complainer people say.
Reservoir Dogs was really honest, raw stuff. So.
Yeah. I don't know why. I look at that, I'm like, I don't see any of Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs or any of that in this. I just see him, like, steering really hard. No, I mean, he's still Quentin Tarantino, but
yeah.
I see him, like, steering really hard into something, a World War II movie I've, like, never, ever even conceived of before. That's just full of conversations, you know? It's like, whoa! This is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay, so now let's talk a bit about Spring.
Mm-hmm.
Since I suck at pitching movies, and some people say it's best to go into the movie knowing as little as possible, how would you pitch it?
You pitch it.
Wait, pitch what?
Spring.
Oh, Spring. Spring's about a young man who flees Southern California in an emotional and legal tailspin, picks a random nowhere trip to Italy, gets to Italy to a small little beautiful Mediterranean town where he sparks up a romance with a girl with a dark secret.
Perfect.
Is that a pretty good... That's pretty spoiler-free, yeah.
That's pretty spoiler-free,
yeah.
So what was the process of getting Spring made?
Yeah, I mean, so Justin wrote Spring while we were mixing Resolution. And so that was before Resolution even had any kind of a...
So how did you already have the Italy idea, or was it set in a random location that you knew how you wanted to feel, but not exactly where it was?
Oh yeah, it was always set along the coast in Italy.
Had you already been to Italy?
Yeah, I'd been to the Amalfi Coast before.
Oh, okay.
A couple times with my family. So... a lot of times, well, for me anyways, when I sit down to write a script, if I have a mental map in my head and I know the locations, it just comes so much faster and it's easier to write. And then the idea of shooting body horror in along the Mediterranean has a visual hook to it, because there's something about putting something really horrific in something so beautiful that just, like, you can see it in your head and it's really neat looking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because, well, I'll cut that from the interview, but I'm working on something that I write.
Yeah.
Which is set in Neuchâtel, but this opposition between, it will be kind of a horror comic book.
Yeah.
And so I completely understand where you come from with the juxtaposition of horror and beautiful scenery.
Yeah.
And so, what was the most challenging aspect of filming Spring?
During filming, I mean, pretty typical stuff. Like, I'd say that it's made on a very small budget, and when you're scheduling out your shoot days, you're trying to schedule it out so that, like, the days it can't be storming, that, you know, you can shoot those days, and if that does happen, that you have some wiggle room later in the schedule to pick it up later or swap things out. But that's the most stressful thing where you're shooting. It's just, what's God gonna do with the weather? And there was one day, you know, the final scene of the movie, them at Pompeii, that place.
So it's Pompeii.
No, it's, well, it gets, we don't use the word Pompeii, but basically it's Pompeii, right?
Because my friend, he's a history major.
Yeah.
And, Antoine, you've met him, the guy I'm doing. And he wanted to ask you a question about the runes.
Yeah.
Which was, Pompeii or Herculaneum?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that there actually are, there's more than one. There's more than one Roman town covered in volcanic rock from that eruption.
Yeah.
So we didn't have to use the word Pompeii specifically, but if you those molds, the people on the ground, those are stolen from Pompeii. We had our production designer make ones, like the famous ones from Pompeii.
Okay.
We wanted to keep those so bad as props, but we couldn't fly on a plane with, like, a human body cast, you know?
Yeah.
We wanted so bad. It was just like, this is so cool. I want this in my living room. And no.
But that
or the dog. Oh, that would have been so cool.
That day, that final scene that needed to not be shot in a hurricane, like, that day, it was just pouring rain, storming. There's no way we could have done it. And then And then magically, towards the second half of the day, everything cleared up and we had just enough time to grab it, to grab that that end shot. But that was the constant thing in that production where it's like, well, we don't get more days, we don't get more money to shoot the movie, so you're just always at the mercy of the weather, and luckily it all worked out.
Yeah.
The next movie we had more wiggle room, which is, it's nice to not have just that. Just the thing where it's like, okay, if it storms this day, you might need to rewrite the script. You know, like, you're out of wiggle room, you can't put it anywhere else, you might have to cut that scene and, like, figure it out. So, the next movie, we don't... That's our big luxury on the next movie, is, like, there's just... You know, unless we have a terrible first assistant director, which we won't, there's no chance of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, in three movies, you will be, like, production engineer, and there's the luxury of saying that you will never work with independent... independent stuff ever again.
Mm-hmm.
So Spring is a monster movie with a brand new, never seen before monster. How did you go into the process of creating it? Was it like always on your mind, or did you read stuff about other monsters? And
I think it wasn't always my mind. I just kind of came up with the concept of how our body operates, and then and then it seemed like visually to have one's body where when these changes are taking place, it turn into all of these kind of creatures from our evolutionary past, or at least creatures that when you look at a very simplified diagram of evolution from single-celled organisms to like salamanders, to fish, to salamanders.
So you do believe in evolution?
And all these things.
You're
you don't think Americans believe in evolution?
yeah.
I actually don't think that it's as simple as the idea presented in Spring, but I do definitely believe in evolution. I still think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
I love the parts of the movie that mentions religions more, and how Louise has seen so many of them and has lived through so many of them. So keeping that in mind, what's your stance on religion? And am I allowed to ask that to American filmmaker, or is this a question that will...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Oh, I don't... I think I was raised without one, but I admire them quite a bit. I like seeing, like, people in temples celebrating stuff and things like that. And I don't really have strong feelings about them either way. And I've heard there's a psychological thing, though, where it's like if you had never been raised within a spirituality or an organized religion by a certain age, that you're just never really quite going to have that experience in life. It's got to get in your brain a little sooner. But I admire them a lot. Like I love seeing things like going by, like whether it's a Mormon temple, a mosque, or like being in Paris and seeing people at Notre Dame, like how moved they are by all of it. It's really neat to see, for sure.
Yeah, kind of the same thing, honestly. I was raised with religion, and I only ever saw it do good, honestly. I mean, I know that it has a really dark history, and of course there's all this terrible stuff that's blamed on religion, probably isn't the right phrase even, just like the cause of religion, I guess, you know. But ultimately, you know, I mean, it's supposed to be a set of moral guidelines that a lot of us can agree upon, you know, as human beings, and so... So I think that's really beautiful, and I also think the I think she actually says it in the movie, but she's like, it's pretty and I like the rituals and, you know, that kind of stuff. Is that's sort of like the amount of human achievement we've had for that, you know, and even just being able to walk around Europe and gorgeous cathedrals and all of that, that's also, you know, something that might not have existed without it, and that's really nice too.
You have a really, well, you have Louise, which is a really strong female character. And so what was the process of writing such a strong female character? Since you're both guys and a lot of male filmmakers tend to shy away from female-led movies and write mainly male protagonists, it was refreshing to see such a good female character. So how did you come up with it?
I don't know. I think you just kind of all my scripts are just kind of written from interactions of human beings in real life, and just kind of like take what I know about women I've known in my life and have her behave and say things in that way. There's always a problem you hit of writing female characters as a male writer or making as two males making a movie with a female character. Sometimes the problem that you can hit, and I think actually I heard some controversy this week about Joss Whedon and
yeah.
I guess the character of Black Widow in the Avengers,
yeah.
And I guess she has an ambition of being pregnant.
No,
the thing is,
I saw it yesterday or 2 days ago, and so the thing is that she says that when spoilers for Avengers ahead, when she became Black Widow in the Red Room, the final step, the graduation gift they gave all the spies is that they sterilize them, and so she's talking to Hulk. Because they have kind of this romance going on,
mm-hmm.
and he tells her, yeah, I'm a monster, I can't have children.
Yeah.
And she answers, you're not the only monster here.
Oh,
because
so
and she explains that she has been sterilized. And so I guess many people took it as, oh, yeah, so women who can't have children are monster, or stuff like that. But I didn't really take it that way. I thought about it like more in the way that a criticism of the fact that because Joss Whedon is such an outspoken feminist, I took it as his way of saying, because Hawkeye, he has a family, and so I took it as a way of Joss Whedon saying that we don't expect the same stuff from guys and from females. So if a female wants to have a career and so on, it would be expected from her not to have children, to shy away from those aspiration.
Yeah.
That it's not the case with male, because we encourage patriarchal society encourages men to have children.
Yeah.
But and have a great career and so on, but not so much with female. Actually, for female, it's a huge disadvantage to have children.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird as any male filmmaker making a movie that has female characters in it, and justifiably so. People see it through a different filter, and sometimes things are taken as being like. I give you an example. Like some people are really offended by Spring that Louise would fall for Evan, who doesn't have any. Literally, it's been like, well, he doesn't have any extraordinary talents. And he's not like this, he's got faults. He's not this really amazing guy, but there she's falling for him, giving up her eternity.
Yeah, and meanwhile, she's giving up eternity and is a rocket scientist and is brilliant and is beautiful and all
yeah.
that.
You know, there's one way to look at that is like, look at these males wish fulfilling to have some woman come take care. You know, that's one
which
yeah,
I find really offensive.
It's very offensive.
What do you find offensive? Characters like many PC dream girls, or is it
no. just them don't choose? No, in that, like, apparently the only qualifications for people being together is that people have, like, an extraordinary talent of
some
sort.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, like, the whole movie is about, like, sometimes you just can't predict it. It's
yeah.
something chemical or magic
yeah,
you don't really know. Like, that's the whole idea of the movie, is that you don't really know why people need to be together. You know, you don't know
yeah.
why. It's not like, oh, of course, they were bound to be together. She fits in like a puzzle piece. You know, it's not like that. And that's the thing where it's like, that was the whole point of the movie, and it just seems like it got like completely missed sometimes. Very rarely, though. Luckily, it seems like most people appreciate Louise's character. But
yeah. We try. But just being male storytellers, you know, we're always going to have some baggage that goes in with that.
Yeah.
But people just see it a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing, too, the other tricky thing is that you know, if I could be totally honest, like living my life, just in my little world of all the people I've known, it was my mom, my sister, girlfriends I've had, all these things, it's like, I might be able to make some generalizations that are differences between men and women. Not negative nor positive, nothing. I'm not saying they can be exactly the same in certain ways. They can behave the same way, whether it's work-wise, sexually, all these things. But there are generalizations that I could probably make, and they're not value judgments. They're neither negative nor positive. But if I take those observations and I put them into a character, I'm always at the risk of being like, but sexist. And it's like, because
yeah.
because that, you know, the, that a good example would be like kind of the Joss Whedon one would be like, that woman just expressed the desire to have children. You're just saying all women are just driven by reproduction. I was like, no, not all women.
That character,
but some do, and that girl did, and yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, but the tricky part with Black
it's
Widow
always tricky.
Is that she's the only female
yeah.
character.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
yeah.
I haven't actually seen the movie, so I don't really know. But in my opinion, it sounds like she's saying that, and the response that might or might not have been said is, she's saying she's a monster, but no one else would. You know, like, that's an absurd statement. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
like, and I think that that's the point, is her, like, judging herself too harshly because
yeah,
she's supposed
exactly.
to fit a societal
yeah.
role, but nobody else would ever say she's a monster for that. They'd be like, wait, that's crazy. That's not your fault, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it's not even like a, you know, that's what it seems like, is it seems like, again, people just finding something to get upset about, especially something that doesn't seem there. And then, you know, I think when we were making Louise, a lot of, if you want to completely avoid that whole discussion, if you want to, then what you have to do is make a character that only has issues that are relatable to both males and females, just human problems. And it's just not honest. It's not an honest thing to do. We have those, for sure we have those in the film. And Evan has those too. And then on top of that, Evan has male problems and she has female problems. And that's just what it is. You know, and that's something where it's like, just trying to speak as truthfully to the characters as you can, you know, is you do have to fill out that entire range, but in doing so, you put yourself in the crosshairs a little bit. But luckily, I mean, it's always done with respect to both genders, you know, as much as we can, and I think that's probably always the best way to do it, is just respecting your characters, you know, through and through.
I mean, there's so much more sexism against men in Spring, though.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about it,
like, frat
so
boy,
much.
The frat
it's
boy, like, the guy in the bar.
There's, every guy in it's,
yeah.
like, a horrible, like...
Yeah.
Mostly Americans.
Evan,
so.
Who just, Evan, who, like, punches a guy out.
You're right. No, I didn't find it sexist at all.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, we made it seem like the movie's just drawn a lot of heat for it. It hasn't, but we've seen it. You know, we've seen it, like, most of the time people do seem to appreciate it.
The thing is that nowadays, I think feminism is... There are as many feminism as there are feminists.
Mm-hmm.
We are all different. But I feel like it's really... it's so new to most people that when you are new to a problem that you just realize is everywhere around you,
mm-hmm.
you tend to be really, really angry about it and get angry more easily because you realize that for years you've been living in the Matrix,
right.
and you see the world for what it is, and it pisses you off that you could have been so fucking far away from the truth and from what it is. So you will kind of nitpick at some stuff.
And weirdly enough, I actually really like that. Even when people get up in arms about something that's not there, especially about feminism, I really like it, just because. Otherwise, it's not my whole upbringing. It wasn't even talked about. There was occasionally, like, you know, once every 3 months, someone would be like crazy feminist, whatever, that kind of thing, idea that would pop in. But now it's part of my everyday conversation online, especially. You know,
yeah.
like, that's something where it's like now people are thinking about it, and not. I don't mean like mincing their words. I mean like they're thinking about it in a way that like there's social change coming. You know, in a way that it's once it's completely in like the worldview that's like microaggressions are a real thing and you don't even realize they're happening, then they actually start going away, and it's really cool. And at a certain point we're going to have a generation that just won't even understand how that happened before, because we've been talking about it so much. You
same
know?
With
so
racism
cool.
and
yeah,
same
yeah.
with
all of it yeah.
yeah.
And that's what's cool, is like even the ones that are like overreactions, it's like I like that better than no conversation.
Exactly, yeah.
You know,
I tend to agree. So it's interesting that from now on, I think there are going to be some pretty heavy spoilers. So if you haven't seen Spring, stop listening. So I think it's interesting that at first the audience knows that Louise is special, but not Evan. Evan is pretty much the last one to know. Was it a way for you to symbolize how at the beginning of a relationship we tend to be blind to someone's feelings? Or was it purely coincidental because it was more interesting for suspense and storytelling?
Oh, it's both, for sure.
Yeah, it's both.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, there's a lot of times when people find metaphor in your films that wasn't necessarily talked about or intended, but that's one that it's like, oh yeah, that's, of course. That one.
Yeah,
that
relationship
one's...
monsters turning literal was like how we like sold the film. You know, not like before we were making it, we're like, that's kind of what's happening here is it follows the beats of a relationship in a way. You know, your first fight, and you know, and find out that they're flawed, and you either dive in anyway or run away. Like, you know, that's kind of the that's kind of the whole thing. And actually, what's funny though is on a surface level, I have this fantasy when I want to waste a whole bunch of my own time to go back and recut the film so that we don't see anything wrong with Louise until he does. So you're just watching, and then like 50 minutes into the film, he just bursts in and there's like a monster on the floor. And you're just like, what the fuck? You know, you have no idea what just happened. I have a fantasy of that. And then he just like, and then he like immediately springs to action and grabs a syringe, and you're like, why did he do that? Run away, what just happened? I like love that idea.
That would be pretty cool. Would be pretty cool.
But it's interesting that in that case, it's a weird little, like, for us, it was a filmmaking lesson in that we learned, like, you know, because we've exposed the audience to this, we're actually able to swallow that Evan doesn't, like, run out of the room, you know?
Yeah,
because
exactly,
otherwise,
yeah,
like, if you didn't expose him, he'd run out of the room, and also your movie would be a ridiculous,
definitely, weird thing.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense in the rhythm, rhythmically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with resolution, you deconstructed friendship. With Spring, you've done the same to romance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever plan on deconstructing family relations?
We do, actually. In our next movie does it a little bit, but that's not really quite so much what we're going after.
Yeah.
We really like one central relationship as much as we can, because you can spend a lot of time with it. And so, you know, our next movie is actually an internal thing. It's kind of him against himself and that struggle. There's a lot of other relationships. It's not quite so metaphorical. But it's not quite the next movie. However, our TV show does that a lot.
Your TV show?
Yeah, we have a TV show that we're taking around that we're not going to go too far into. I'm sorry. But it is but basically it is kind of about our obsession with like male anti-heroes and do we see them as like modern flawed father figures that and also like a familial relationship with mothers. It's more of a parent-child relationship than a whole family dynamic. Yeah.
Okay. I have one last question that I didn't get to. Oh yeah. So it's a question about the ending of the movie. Do you think Louise and Evan works out or in the long run, or do they break up after like 3 years after the kid is born?
What do you think?
I'm not the person to ask. No,
because you haven't watched it yet, because it hasn't been released legally in Switzerland.
No, I definitely watched it.
No, I'm just kidding. I said
to
you. You're fine.
I'm quite pessimistic nowadays. So I don't think they kind of work out because she's given up something so huge for him. So maybe she's had enough time for not caring about, maybe she's seen enough, but I feel like when you are in a relationship and you give up, and one person gives up, well, eternity
mm-hmm.
for someone else, at one point
or
another, there's an imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
So
I won't tell you yes or no, because there is no definitive answer. The movie ends when it ends, but I will say that for me and Justin, we think that no matter what happens with them, and hang on, I will give a less cop-out answer, but no matter what happens with them, it was all worthwhile.
Even her giving it all up.
Because of two things. One is they would have never known, and that would have been a problem.
Yeah.
And two is, no matter what, they're at least really, really good friends.
Yeah.
I think at the very least, like, these are just two people that work together one way or another, and they're, you know... And they've got some kind of a relationship in the future, whether or not it's a romantic one. It's not something that's, you know... I think if they end up breaking up, I think it would be a really sad day in Louise's life when Evan passes away. You know, or if she didn't, you know, give up.
Yeah.
I think that would have been a really bad day in her life.
Yeah.
You know, so...
We met this woman the other day that had had two husbands. And she had this one husband, like, 20 years ago. And she says that every Sunday... She's remarried now, but every Sunday she gets together with her ex-husband and they walk around the park and they talk about his job as a journalist. and she works in the film industry, and that's a really beautiful thing. Like, that's a really beautiful thing. Like, I've had relationships break up where, you know, the girl never, like, nothing particularly bad happened, but the girl never wants to speak to me ever again. And it's like, well, thank God that didn't go any further, because there was nothing except.
Yeah, that's,
you know, there's.
Thing,
I'm not saying romance isn't a beautiful thing, but I think maybe the deeper thing is.
I get it because I'm friends with all of my exes who still wants to.
Yeah.
Because if you see something that is worth having a romantic relationship with someone, it's that this something will always be there, even if it's just for friendship.
Yeah, the friendship's kind of the more sacred thing, maybe.
Yeah.
In some situations, a lot of situations, like, that's the most sacred thing. It's like that. Not to say that, again, romance is like a beautiful, amazing thing. We made a movie about it, and that's why people like it. They like seeing that. But something we told Nadia and Lou through the whole process was that we want people to, like, when faced with the question of, like, do you think they're still friends if nothing else, that hopefully they'd say yes.
So you achieved your goal.
And actually, on the Blu-ray, there is an alternate ending that tells you what happens 9 months later. Only on the Blu-ray.
Oh.
I'll send you a Vimeo link. But
okay, perfect. Because I don't have a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for answering my questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
One last word.
Oh, if you guys want to talk to us, I know we talked about social networking, but just tweet at us.
Yeah, at Justin H. Benson.
And I'm at Aaron Moorhead. That's it.
Perfect, thank you. And that was Aisha Gary Scottman. Bye.